Thank you for turning out on a rainy day, although maybe your options for doing other things are So somebody came in a little early and they said, oh, I see we're doing First Ruth today. I said, well, we'll have to write Second Ruth after the class. But yeah, we'll be looking at Ruth and concentrating on the first chapter, although we'll have to go a little fast forward through the book to get at some of the main themes as well, the four chapters. So now where are we going to find Ruth? Does everybody have a Bible? And, well, close to Judges, good. Yeah, why is it close to Judges in
our Bible?
The time frame, good. Okay, so the setting, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Okay, and a certain man from Bethlehem meaning the house of bread, in Judah, went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So if you find Judges, then Ruth will be right after Judges. Sure, let's have a little bit of life.
More light.
Twisted and push it. Okay, so if we had Jewish Bibles, Ruth would not be in this place. It would be toward the end of the Bible, in a section called the Writings. So you'd have the Law, you know, the five books of Moses, the Torah, and then you have the Prophets, which would include the historical. We say the historical books, but Ruth would be pulled out, and it would be in a last section called the Writings, and it would be among five very short books called the Scrolls, the five Megillot, the five Scrolls. And each one of these is read at a different Jewish holiday over the course of the year, so that the Song of Songs, that most intimate relationship between God and Israel in the Jewish tradition, it's read at Passover, where Israel was closest to God. And then next is Ruth. It was read at what we would call Pentecost, or weeks, 7 weeks after Passover. And that's traditionally a season of harvest, and so that corresponds with what we'll see in Ruth. There's a lot of harvesting of barley, a lot of emphasis on Ruth gleaning the barley at the edges of the fields, which was the right of the poor in the culture. That was their security net, their workfare or whatever. Just, you know, you could go out and you could glean among the edges. And then, if we were to continue, the Book of Lamentations is recited during the summer observance of the destruction of the first and second temple. And then Ecclesiastes is in the fall during the beautiful season of Sukkot, where people dwell in booths, remembering the time in the wilderness as a special, sweet time with God where everybody was pretty much equal. And then finally Esther, one of my favorites, during Purim that commemorates the survival of the Jews from genocide under the Persians and in other places. But okay, so today we're going to look at Ruth, and I have this beautiful drawing. Talk about the many-colored grace of God. This beautiful piece of art by artist Heike. We'll think a little bit more about it, but there seems to be some intertwining here of the two figures of Ruth and Naomi, and even a suggestion, I think, of you see a baby there being embraced, and of Orpah, the sister-in-law who turned away there, also being part of the triad there, even though she's perhaps made the wiser choice in conventional perspective. So we're going to move on from Babel to Hagar, to the story of the Pharaoh's adoption of Moses, to the story of immigration. And I think it's especially appropriate in our age when we are considering our policies concerning immigrants, to look at this book that features sort of a double immigration story. Although the book's called Ruth, the story actually begins with a story of immigration and immigration from Judah to Moab. So you have this Judean family out of necessity for survival immigrating to Moab and finding a place where they can flourish, at least for a time, even set up the next generation. And you have intermarriage there. So a lot of the topics, you know, that are really current for people coming into the country in the first generation. And then we have the return then of Naomi, now that her husband and two sons are dead, with Ruth. So Ruth, who elects, I mean, this is interesting. She's not forced at all. In fact, she is strongly encouraged to stay at home where she could be part of her own people and find a husband there and have the support system that she needed. But she chooses to become an alien, a foreigner, an immigrant, out of loyalty to her mother-in-law, which is really unheard of in a patriarchal culture, to have that commitment to another woman. So we'd be looking at this outsider, this Moabite woman. And if, as we're reading parts of Ruth, notice how the narrator keeps repeating that she's a Moabite, the Moabite Ruth, Ruth, the Moabite, the Moabite, the Moabite, the Moabite. She's always outsider, always outsiders. But through the course of this narrative and through the loyalty that she shows and that she's recognized for, she becomes really embraced by the community and actually becomes recognized as the ancestress of David, and then of course in the New Testament also of Christ. So just as we're starting to read the book of Ruth, let's look at a map quickly, and we'll see that this is Israel in the northern part of the country, northern hill country, and Judah with its capital at Jerusalem. And it doesn't have Bethlehem. But Bethlehem, Beit Lehem, is just slightly, it's about three to 5 miles here south. It's a second here. Southeast of Jerusalem. Thank you. Southeast of Jerusalem. And its meaning is Beit is house and Lehem is bread. So it's the bread basket of the country. And so you start with an irony, right, that there's a famine there. And Naomi decides to return when there is bread. Yesh lechem, there is bread in House of Bread. So, but her whole family then just travels just across, probably just across the Jordan River there too. Here's Moab, Ammon, Edom, these small countries, Aram here. But they go to Moab and cross this, the Jordan, which is a dividing line traditionally, but in this case also the crossing of it serves to actually bring together two women of different ethnic background, the woman from Judah and the Moabite Ruth. So let's read a little bit. I always like to get into the text. Any questions before we start about anything that I've said so far? Yes,
I always thought that Ruth couldn't go back to her people because she had married a foreigner and they would not accept her.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The custom of the time.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, let's read the story and see if there's something in the text that indicates that. But you know, perhaps we don't know the
right
motivation.
Uh huh.
She declares her loyalty to her mother-in-law is the reason, but perhaps she has mixed motivations. That does get us to think about what happens to somebody who, you know, crosses that line of intermarriage too, and as well. So thank you for that. Thank you very much.
Esther?
Yeah.
You always look at the meaning of names.
Yes.
Is there any Hebrew thing of Naomi and Ruth?
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. So I got some help with these slides. I'm going to tell you these beautiful slides. Oh, yes, so there's the tree of Jesse, the whole lineage here. Ruth's not depicted on there, unfortunately, but she could be. So William and Laura Gentry helped me find these slides last night because I couldn't get internet. So we had really a lot of fun looking at the different options and saying, oh, this is the many-colored grace of God, thinking, oh, this is perfect. But Laura had a kind of synopsis by a Hebrew scholar, Tikva Frymer-Kensky, who rewrote the story, not just using the names, but translating the names, which is great. So that Bethlehem, of course, is House of Bread. And then Elimelech is Naomi's husband, means my God is king. Naomi means my pleasantness, my sweetie, my delight, right? Mm-hmm. And Mahlon and Chilion, they're two sons, they mean sickness and early death. So you can tell that they're characters. No one would name their children this, right? So you can tell that the role in the story is what's being emphasized, right? Not, and then as far as Ruth, probably it comes from a word which means companion or associate. So friend. She's the friend, which what a beautiful name for someone who's pledged their chesed, their loyalty, their enduring faithfulness to Naomi and to her people and to her God. And Orpah means the back of the neck. So she was sensible, but she turned the back of her neck. You see she's turning her neck there. And Boaz, a traditional meaning of Boaz, means in him there is strength. So he's the Goel, he's the next of kin, he's the one who's entrusted with writing the situation. There's actually another next of kin who's a little closer, but he declines to play that role because it will damage his own economic interests. And so Boaz, in him there is strength. And then as far as their child, Obed means servant. So they give birth to the servant who actually then leads to the beloved. David is the beloved. So all these names, you know, if you know some Hebrew and you're reading along, it makes a lot of difference. You know, the characters are kind of their personalities and their roles. They're already indicated in the words. So I really appreciate that you asked that question. But let's read a little bit so we can actually get into the text. And I think as we're going along a little bit, in the back of your mind, not always in the front, but about our situation with immigration today and what this book might suggest. That'll be like an open question at the end of our Bible study. So, shall we start at this? I always look at here because I'm right-handed and I was pointing over here. So why don't we start over here and have someone read about five verses. Ruth 1.
Uh-huh. This is a new beginnings.
Okay.
Now it came to pass in the days that the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion.
Mm-hmm. Don't name your sons that.
They were Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. Mm-hmm. and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband.
Okay, very good. Let's see what we can see here. Naomi has a hard life here. There doesn't seem to be any negative, there's no negative spin on the fact that Mahlon and Chilion also, that they marry foreign wives, but it is noted. So she starts out, Naomi is really becomes the main character at the end of this, doesn't she? She's left.
And no grandkids.
No grandkids, exactly, no grandkids. So she's the immigrant who's left alone without that support system there in Moab. All right, so then we have a shift. What's she going to do? Do you want to continue, Esther?
Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Mm-hmm. Therefore she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." Mm-hmm. Shall we stop at 10?
Okay, let's stop at 10, see if we have anything we want to point out. So it starts out that there's no bread in House of Bread, but then Naomi hears that there is bread in House of Bread, and it's attributed to the Lord, a gift of food. Okay, so she's going to return home, but her advice is that the daughter-in-laws stay there. And they seem to have a very good relationship, right? I should ask you, what do you think their relationship is? It does seem. May the
close.
Lord, very close, uh-huh. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So, she even wishes that God would model his behavior to them on how loyal they have been to her family. Yes?
Is there significance? I noticed it said return to your mother's house.
To return to
and
your
all
mother's
the men
house.
Are passing on. In my translation, it says parents, but I noted mothers.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that's significant or not.
Yeah. Well, isn't that interesting? So what do you have? It starts with a story of a certain man in Bethlehem, and by the time you get to verse 6, there are no men left in the story whatsoever, are they? So it's a story that kind of masquerades as like the story of a man. And at the end, also you have this male genealogy. But in between, it's really a story of women and their relationships and so forth. So it seems to fit in with that Naomi, who seems to be a kind of a mother figure to her daughters-in-law, they seem to be living with her because she's having to tell them to go back to their own mothers, right? So I think you're onto something, that we really have a story embedded within a kind of envelope that stresses the male figures, both, you know, the husband and then later the genealogy, also the men at the gate. But in the midst of that, you have a story of women that are working together. Sometimes in very clever ways, to find happiness, to find a future, to find security, and the security for them and the joy comes in the form of this child who is also significant. So I think that is telling. And let me just, I'll check with this. Verse 8. Yes, it says, in Hebrew it says, Isha, each woman, levet ima, to the house of her mother. So Naomi's going to Beit Lechem, the house of bread, but she says, go each to Beit Ima, to the house of her mother. So it does emphasize that.
Question.
So, yes.
In verse 9, it says, each of you grant you rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Whose husband are they? Is that a reference to remarriage?
Yes, uh-huh. She thinks that the best thing for them would be to go home, live with their moms for a while, and get remarried. Because then they would have, once again, in the patriarchal society, access to the everything that the land, you know, owning land would provide in an agricultural society. And
in,
the males
in
would
my
be.
My translation, it uses the word security,
security
rather than rest.
Uh huh, uh huh. Okay, so in Hebrew, the word is menucha. Menucha is from a root. That's related to Noah, and Noah is the one who gave us rest from our labors because he invented wine. So it is rest, but it's the kind of, I guess security would mean, you know, they can relax, they can feel, they don't have to worry, you know, menucha. So it would be rest, kind of a rest, a calm. You can have calm, you can have repose, right? And I guess security would be related to that because you wouldn't feel at ease unless you had that kind of security. Yes.
Uh-huh. No, I thought widow's remarriage was not very common in those days because even in India, 100 years ago, that was unheard of, and only later widows remarried. I was surprised that she suggested that.
To go get remarried? Well, we do have remarriage of widows. Think any famous ones come to mind in the Bible? Biblical widows? Yes.
Martha Washington.
Who's that? Oh, Martha Washington. Interesting. No, I didn't know that.
And also Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha.
Was a widow.
Oh, yeah. David married a widow.
There you go. Of course, he made her a widow.
No, the other one.
The other one, too.
Bathsheba.
Uh-huh. But who took
Abigail. Uh-huh.
He married two widows.
He married two. He was always marrying widows, yes. Well, he was kind of a consolidating his power as he was marrying these different women who had sort of prestigious husbands.
Didn't the brother marry, if a person was widowed, the brother would marry? Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's a Levirate law. And that comes into play in Ruth as well. That's right. Mm-hmm. So the custom is that you have one of the brothers dies, and then it's the responsibility of the next of kin, the translator is the redeemer, but the next of kin to marry or to serve in the place of the brother to raise up a son that's actually going to be the offspring of the dead brother. So he would inherit so the line would continue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, if you think when I read 9 and I saw security here, I was thinking in what you had mentioned about think of it from the standpoint of immigration, and I thought maybe she sensed that there was going to be a difficulty for them to follow her into this back to
Yeah, that's Judaism. Good. Mm-hmm. That word security really does resonate when we start talking about immigration now here, doesn't it? Yes. Uh huh. So that she's worried for them.
Yeah.
She's worried for them. If you come over, and if you're going to be a foreigner, oh, who knows, maybe she's experienced some difficulty being an outsider in Moab. But she wants them to feel secure. And she thinks the best thing for them is to stay in Moab with their own families, with their mothers, and then eventually remarry and have a secure life there. And they both weep, and they both say no. I need to point out one other thing here in this, in these verses that's important, and that's, I think it's in verse 8. go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you. Deal kindly with you. Now that's a kind of a, that's kind of sweet, right? Ya'aseh Adonai imechem chesed. Deal kindly. Kindly here is like a very strong word, though. It's much better than just like being nice. Kindly is this word, and I write it real big, but I have to write it in darker letters, so you can learn one word of Hebrew, which is chesed. Okay, say that word. Chesed. If you learn that word, you know something really essential about God's character and about the values in Hebrew society and religion. Chesed is what is often translated as God's loving kindness. It's actually stronger than that. It's loyalty. It's covenant loyalty. It's sticking with someone through thick and thin, the good and the bad. That's chesed. And that's the quality of Israel's God, is chesed. A God that comes into relationship, engages, and no matter what the other party does, always comes back. Sees you through, you know, the worst of your times and goes forward to a new beginning. That's chesed. And so what Naomi is saying, the translation is too weak. May the Lord deal kindly with you. May the Lord deal as a family member, as a close, you know, your closest family members, that you're there for each other when you really need it. So that's very strong, because that also, as the book goes on, Boaz recognizes that Ruth also has showed chesed, or this kind of family loyalty to Naomi and to her people. And so it's a beautiful book, and I think this is one of the themes. It's this kind of loyalty, unexpected loyalty here, you know, between these two women, both of whom have had that immigrant experience, and especially Ruth's chesed. But this is what Naomi wishes for her daughters-in-law, chesed, that the Lord show them chesed. As you have dealt with the dead and me. So in other words, these daughters have been loyal, daughter-in-laws have been loyal family members. And they have been there through the deaths of their husbands, right? They seem to have stayed with their mother-in-law. That's already a real testimony to their relationship and also the character of these two women. Okay, any other questions or comments? Let's go on now a little bit. Here, and they said, we were 11, they said, no, we will return to you and your people. So did somebody pick that up then? Do you want to just continue?
From 12?
Yes, from 11, actually.
But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you then wait until they were grown? Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me. Then they wept aloud again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so she encourages them again, turn back. Why will you go with me? Now, this is odd. Somebody was talking about the Levirate marriage practice. So Naomi is referring to that. Do I still have sons in my womb? In other words, if there had been another brother, or even if a brother were now born, even if Naomi had a son, that son could play the role of the next of kin and marry or have sexual relations with these daughter-in-laws. They could bear children, and then Mahlon and Chilion would still, their lineage would still be alive. Mm. It's a little bit different way of thinking about things, about the, you know, the importance of the family line. So she's saying, look, you know, I'm probably not going to have more sons, so this isn't going to work out. And even if tonight I had, you know, I conceived and I had a child within a year, are you going to wait like 13 years, 14, 15 years? So she says, no, this is highly unlikely. And so she says it's far more bitter. Bitter Mara is the name that Naomi takes for herself when she returns to the village of Bethlehem, and she says, "Why to the women? Why are you calling me my sweet, my sweetness? You call me Mara, because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me." So that's another name meaning. Okay, so they're weeping again. It's very dramatic. Orpah kisses her mother-in-law, clearly very affectionate. Ruth clings to her. Now this is interesting. Clings, davak. This word is used in Genesis 2, right? When at the end of Genesis 2, it says, "Therefore a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh." So this clinging, it's really, I think this is a really fascinating portrayal of this kind of clinging, almost becoming one flesh here in their closeness.
Hey, Esther, would you write the Hebrew word for clinging?
Yes, sure. It's also, today, it's the word in modern Hebrew for glue. It's like sticking that close together.
It's like Elmer's?
Yeah, like Elmer's. Davak is how you pronounce it.
Davak.
Davak. Davka, she clung to her.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Right. And this kind of marital imagery, really, is continued, right, in this, in the words then that that Ruth says, which are often recited at weddings. So it's this kind of close commitment, you know, come what will. So let's have somebody read these next verses with that.
"And she said, 'Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave you, or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me.' When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her."
Okay, very good. She stopped speaking to her. Interesting. I guess stop speaking to her, trying to convince her, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
It's amazing the allegiance they have to their mother-in-law as opposed to their mother.
To their mother. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it significant when you said return to your gods, plural, small g? Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You know, Ruth
not,
is...
She was not a convert, not considered a Jew.
Uh-huh. Yeah, each nation had their own gods, according to sort of the understanding in this ancient world.
She's saying, may God take care of you, but then return to your gods.
Your gods, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So possibly while they were part of the family of Elimelech, my God is king, you know, they were incorporated into the whatever religious practices that they would have within the family. But each region actually was viewed as having its own God or gods in those times. So for them to stay there, they would return to the observance. Yeah, they're very good. Let me check this out here. I think that what we've had this proper name, Lord, right, or Adonai, which is the Israelite God throughout here, but here you have return to your gods, not a specific name of any god, but just generic. Yeah, Eloheha. Okay.
It's a plural.
It's a plural. It's a plural in Hebrew. Elohim, the plural, can also mean God with a capital G too. Oh. So it is Eloheha. It's an interpretation. Eloheha. It could be your God, capital G. But usually, when it's other people's deities, the translation choice is to make it plural. I guess because of the understanding of polytheism. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did girls
did girls' families give dowries?
Oh.
Because if they did, maybe the girls knew their parents wouldn't have any more dowries, and what would encourage a man to marry them if there was no dowry? Their parents may just feel like, well, I took care of you already, or at least the mothers, and, you know, now we, you know, we can't have you live with us, you know?
Now, let's think of some examples. Let's think of, for example, Jacob, when he goes up to live with Laban, what's the relationship there? He actually has to work. Yeah, he has to work. So it's actually the male has to compensate the family of the bride for basically taking one of their members, because they would live, that the women would go to live with the husband's family. So they'd lose a laborer, they'd lose, you know, a beloved family member, and so forth. So, yeah, it's a little different. Or even you think when Abraham sent up his servant to find a wife for Isaac, he puts gold, he gives gold to her. So it's the cost is borne by the male, at least in the stories that we have, these early stories. But that's a great question. Okay, it's really striking, isn't it? Okay, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people should be my people. Oh, wow. Okay, your God, my God. And so Ruth is often seen as, you know, the first convert. Where you die, I will die, and there be buried. So even beyond death, you know, the physical body, may the Lord do thus and so to me. If even death parts me, I'm not even going to let death separate us. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Are we assuming now that Orpah would go back to her gods, since you said it could be a capital G? Because I was thinking about immigrants coming to our country. They always came together. And basically, at the time when the immigrants came to begin with, they were Christians. But they were in the German community or the, you know, Scandinavian community or whatever.
To follow your own observations.
Yeah, and so are we making assumptions that these were gods, or by making a small g?
Oh, okay.
That's just kind of an open-ended question, I guess.
Well, there would be like kind of chief gods in various regions, like Milcom was one, god of the Ammonites, Dagon was god of the Philistines, and so forth. So they would have like main gods, but a lot of most of the gods they had, the head gods had lesser gods. So there were pantheons. So that would be really, really common to have sort of a pantheon. But yeah, even religious dimensions to staying on with someone. And I don't know. Do you have other stories of people, immigrants converting? And I don't know. Sometimes they do. I know, to fit into a community.
Apropos of a little humor.
Good.
Whither thou goest, I will go. Elizabeth Taylor turned Jewish for Mike Todd. And use that in their ceremony.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
We all know
that. Excellent. Thank you for pointing out that use.
See, for Indian Christians, it's a big issue.
Big issue, yes.
Because if your children are marrying a Hindu or Muslim, it's invariably, I cannot generalize, but in general, the children take on the mother's god.
Okay.
Even if they're Catholics and Protestants or something like that, usually if the mother is Catholic, they go to the Catholic Church. That's not a generalization.
So intermarriage would it would mean a big change. Have religious. So we have that here too, right?
Yeah.
Strong bond.
Right.
It happens.
Yeah. Thank you.
Going back to this, the immigration factor. Here we have the immigrant making this commitment to go to a land that's not there. And I assume that she would absorb that language, she'll take those practices, and all that would go, whereas I look at today, and I'm not so sure that that is necessarily the viewpoint that we deal with here, is that they want to retain a lot of their identities. And that. So that's
Well, that's interesting, because she's an individual, right?
Right.
So yeah, Ruth is just one individual, and she's going not out of a desire to stay alive because of a famine or economic gain or anything, but you know, she doesn't know if she's going to have a husband or anything, but she just out of that commitment, that sort of unreasonable commitment to her mother-in-law, she's an individual, which would make a difference rather than like a whole group traveling together. But that's an excellent point. Good. Okay, so let's continue here on to the reception by the women. Will you continue?
So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Call me no longer Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned together with Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest.
Okay, there's the barley harvest. And so the barley harvest and the threshing floor and everything play in this season. Look how, in 22, look how the narrator keeps emphasizing. You know, your point was that Ruth would have assimilated, but the narrator keeps calling her Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. It's like, how much more can you say? She's a foreigner! She's different! And I mean, if you kind of skim through it, it just keeps saying that. It's like, okay, if you don't get it, she's, okay, like, okay, for example, look in chapter 2, verse 5. We're introduced to Boaz, who's this next of kin, a prominent rich man. She's, Ruth is gleaning among the sheaves. And he says, "The Lord be with you." The answer, "The Lord bless you." So now we know how people greeted each other in Israelite society. Then Boaz says to his servant, this is in 2:5, who was in charge of the weavers, "To whom does this young woman belong?" There's the status of women too.
Right.
He can't identify her as being a member of one of the local families. And the servant who is in charge of the reaper, "She is the Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." I mean, there again, she's the Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. You can't, you know, that seems excessive, right?
Boaz.
In this translation, it says the Moabite damsel.
What's that?
She is referred to as the Moabish damsel.
The Moabish damsel. That's nice. What translation? Is that the King James?
Gideon.
Anyway, if you go through it, just keeps emphasizing that she's a foreigner throughout. So she must keep at least some of her accent, distinctive qualities, or probably, you know, it was a small town, so that everybody just knew her as the Moabite. They don't even have her name there. She's the Moabite who came back with Naomi from, they don't even need to know her name. She's the Moabite, yeah.
It's so funny, you know, I did the style show on saris yesterday.
Uh-huh.
After the style show, one of the young people who are helping out at Holden, he came and asked me, "What's the name of the girl who wore that outfit?"
He doesn't even get the name, does he? Oh gosh. Well, this is and then look at when she introduced. Okay, so Boaz singles her out and says, "Keep close to the young women, so that I've ordered the young men not to bother you." And he gives her, you know, things to eat and drink and so forth. So she in 2:10, she falls on her face, she bows to him and says, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner?" You know, so both the narrator and Ruth herself, everyone's just...
Back in verse 8, he addresses her as my daughter.
My daughter. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like he's taking her in. So there's, it's that's such a beautiful reference. He's using a kinship term for her, my daughter, a protective kinship term, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. My daughter, BT. Mm-hmm. So, but he knows, and let's look at a little bit more about the loyalty, the loyalty of, unexpected loyalty of this immigrant Moabite in 2:11. Boaz answers her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me. How you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come." What refuge. Beautiful. Now, who else left their native land? It sounds like Abraham. It's like she's being portrayed by Boaz as sort of a parallel figure to Abraham, who left the land of his birth, father and mother, native land.
And so did Jesus, meaning Joseph went to Egypt.
To Egypt, uh-huh. Right, there you have an example of another immigrant experience. Yes, there to flee for safety, right? Mm-hmm. But it's fascinating to me that, first of all, Boaz calls her my daughter, this endearing term, and then he compares her implicitly to Father Abraham, who left his homeland, his native land, not knowing where he was going, right, to a place that he did not know. So this immigrant woman gets these really beautiful descriptions. Okay. Well, as things continue, they unfold. You know, in chapter 3, Naomi, Ruth's gathering all the grain for Naomi herself. She's working hard. Where is Naomi? Why is Naomi not out in the field with her? I don't know. That kind of makes me a little irritated.
Wondering has a bad bang. She cannot.
There's. A Korean student told me that in some circles in Korea, he said the book of Ruth is actually used as a biblical text that instructs daughter-in-laws, especially foreign daughter-in-laws, to obey their mother-in-law. Do whatever they say. See how Ruth went out in the fields and did all the work. But anyway, but she shows her loyalty not just by her words, but also by going out there, working in the hot sun, and providing for them. And so Naomi finally rises to the occasion in 3 and tries to find some rest for Ruth, which maybe she needed after working out in the fields all that time. And so she tries to set up Ruth with Boaz, with this seduction, right, at the threshing floor. It's a risky kind of tactic. Exposes Ruth to sexual harassment, you know? She's vulnerable. She is. She's going out by herself, all dressed up, to a place where men are working late at night. So things turn out okay, but it's really a risk. Yes, uh-huh.
Well, two things. I think probably... Boaz was attracted to Ruth physically, mm-hmm. and then he was the next door kin.
So these things work together. So those things work together, plus the fact that he seems to have some power over or control over the situation with the other workers and all that. So and even protects Ruth's reputation. You know, once she actually comes down there and says, make sure you leave before it gets light, right? So nobody knows that you were down here at the threshing floor. But as things turn out, okay, so she basically goes down, dresses up, uncovers his feet. Now, her mother-in-law had said, you know, that she should wash, anoint herself, put on your best clothes, go down to the threshing floor. Don't make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies down. Then go uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do. The feet, once again, being the euphemism for the lower part of the body, or even the loins or genitals. And all that it said, he says, he will tell you what to do. Mm. So Boaz is, Naomi expects Boaz to tell, take charge. Ruth does most, does everything that her mother-in-law tells her, but what I like is that Ruth doesn't do what he says, he does what Ruth says. I love this. She does everything that her mother-in-law says, except that when she says, he will tell you what to do, if you look at verse 8, at midnight the man was startled and turned over, and there lying at his feet was a woman, and he said, who are you? And she said, I'm Ruth, your servant. So she uses her name. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin. And that language of being under the wings of the Lord, where God kind of comes here, spread your cloak over your servant. And he says, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. Once again, my daughter, showing both the age difference and also that kind of kinship relationship. This last instance of your loyalty. Now they translate chesed as loyalty, of your kindness, of your loyalty, is better than the first, for you've not gone after the young men, whether rich or poor.
So, King James still says kindness.
Kindness. King James says kindness. So that's chesed. Everybody say chesed again. Chesed. So she's showing chesed. Boaz is sort of feeling his age or something. He's like, well, you know, you could have chosen somebody younger, more attractive, or whatever, but you're so committed to your family, this family, your chesed, your loyalty, that you're continuing the lineage by observing this ancient custom of the next of kin raising up offspring for the deceased member of the family. And there's apparently another kinsman, right? And so they have to negotiate that. So Boaz has to go to the gate and negotiate that. And Mr. So-and-so, who's the other kinsman, Aloni Poloni, Mr. So-and-so, he doesn't get a name. At first he's eager to acquire the fields of Naomi, but then he realizes that it comes along with Ruth. So in other words, Ruth's child will inherit the fields, right? So it's gonna. So Mr. So-and-so would have to take care of those fields all these years only for Ruth's child, which would actually be, you know, this deceased husband's child to inherit. So he says, no, he's not gonna do it. So they have this ancient sandal ceremony. Exchange sandals, and Boaz acquires Ruth the Moabite, and the blessings are so wonderful. Look at 4:11. All the people who were at the gate, along with the elders, said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. So this Moabite woman then, once again, is compared to these matriarchs, Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you produce the children in Ephrathah, and may bestow a name. There you go, bestow a name in Bethlehem, so an enduring legacy. And through the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman, may your house be built up like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Tamar is the Davidic ancestress. Tamar bore to Judah in Genesis 38. We don't have really time to go into it, but just amazing that they too accept her, and they compare her to all these pillars, these matriarchs of society. And finally, she does have a son, and then Ruth disappears. All right, so in 4:14, the women come to Naomi. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin. May his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is more to you than seven sons has borne him. So the child is seen as the restorer of the family. Obed is his name, the servant. But in recognizing that the Lord has provided this continuation of the legacy, the women say, they recognize that the daughter-in-law, Ruth, loves you and is more to you than seven sons. Yeah. That's high praise in that society. And everyone's delighted, and this ends up being the lineage of David. Yes?
Well, Boaz was actually taking a chance because she had been married for 10 years earlier and had no children.
Had no children, right.
So it was the Lord.
It was the Lord, yes.
So Boaz was unmarried all this time?
I sense he was married. I don't know. They you know, you could have multiple wives, and so it doesn't say anything about it. And the Levirate marriage, it would be an additional wife if you had other wives. So unfortunately, we don't know anything about Boaz's marital life. But here's a Rembrandt picture. Notice how big Boaz is there, the redeemer figure. It really emphasizes Boaz as sort of the redeemer figure, whereas actually, you know, there in Ruth is beautiful. Naomi seems to be in the shadows. And finally, this is William Blake with the two daughters, with Naomi, you know, with her bitterness really apparent, with Orpah turning her neck, and Ruth clinging, right? She's clinging. It almost looks like a pregnancy, doesn't it? Like she's forming the full belly of her mother, that her mother-in-law that she could not form. Beautiful. And sort of the cruciform figure of Naomi with her hands out there, really striking.
Her hands are so gigantic.
Oh, yeah. They are, aren't they? They're very big.
Clearly elderly. Mm-hmm.
Now, Laura Gentry suggested that those of you who went to the Enneagram session might wonder, what Enneagram would Naomi be? Anyway, she's highly dramatic, isn't she?
Yes.
Don't call me beautiful, call me bitter for the Lord. No, daughter-in-laws, go, for the Lord has dealt with me more bitterly. I mean, she must have been kind of a flamboyant personality. I really like her.
Yes.
And I it's called Ruth because Ruth is the immigrant, so the one who volunteers to come and be a foreigner. And you know, as an outsider, and then is incorporated. But Ruth is a delightful character too, in that she does have this close relationship. You know, these two women from different ethnic backgrounds somehow work it out, and it's a joy and a blessing through chesed, both of the Lord and to each other. Yes.
Well, that word chesed, I keep looking at it, and I think we have the word adhesive. And adhesive.
Adhesive.
It's the same principle. I mean, it's very, it's there instinctively. And I thought, is that a connection?
I don't think there's a cognate, but yeah, there's something. Let's stick it to the stickiness. It would resonate. Well, does anybody have any thoughts about immigration and so forth in light of all this? Yes.
I was thinking about all those things we've been kind of going through with the diversity issue, and you know, when we think about people that come into our culture, we kind of think of them, we don't know their name, but we might know their ethnic culture, and so you hear this, and until you really get to know Ruth, now you have the story of Ruth, and I think of my daughter that we adopted from China, you know, you think of her as Chinese, but once you know her, you think past the Chinese and think of her as Maya, once you get to know her, and this is the same story that the Lord tries to tell us, is that once you get to know that person and get to know their name, I think the origin and where you're from doesn't matter anymore. And this was the acceptance parts of Ruth, that she's no longer thought of anything else. She's the same person, and she's this blessing that came to these people. And if we think about all people that way, that everybody has a blessing to amongst all of us, whatever your culture is, whatever you look like, and do that. And so that's what I take of it, is that this is another story of the Lord ingraining us all together as one.
So. Thank you. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Kind of following on the same theme, I think the community response here, again, initially, she's a foreigner, that's what you said. Mm-hmm. That's what she saw. But at the end, this story of the community acceptance is quite a lesson for us if in our immigration stories, if we as communities could get to know people and
And even come, I mean, they're using the best comparisons, the best blessings that they can out of their own tradition to just cloak her with honor. Yeah, thank you very much. Yes.
The real kicker to all this is that the concluding verses, where they say, "Here's this outsider, this foreigner, this alien, this undocumented person," and she thanks to her story, we have David.
We have David.
We have this acknowledged hero and and Savior of our nation.
Right, and then, you know, in Matthew, thanks to her, we have Jesus as well.
Yeah.
So thanks to the immigrant, to the foreigner who's blessed us with their presence and with their chesed. So you want to have the final words?
I was just going to say that both of those women, Naomi and Ruth, really worked at the assimilation, too, into the culture.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's true, that they got them, Naomi got her connected and so
and
forth.
Ruth
and
worked with her hands and humbly and,
and was working among the others in the community. Yes.
And as Lutheran Christians, I think we should be very proud because we have embraced Laotians, Vietnamese, you know, all those immigrants, you know, providing shelter. In our church, we did that. So I think, in a way, I should be proud of who we are.
We're motivated by that that desire to embrace the immigrant and the foreigner myths. So,
I was just going to say, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes, as in this story, it takes time to learn to know each other.
Right.
When we do, it's great.
Excellent. And it can be lovely, as Naomi this found. So have a blessed day. The Lord be with you, and may you experience God's chesed today and in all days.